The thing that I found most surprising is that once you get a seat at the table, you realize that it's not so special to be there.
Welcome to the Technical Difficulties Podcast. I'm Liz Gerber, and a design professor at Northwestern.
And I'm Lauren Lin, and I'm a student who has also worked in the design industry. Each week, we speak with women leaders in design and technology.
Welcome or welcome back to the Technical Difficulties Podcast, where we celebrate the careers of amazing female designers and technologists. We are so excited to welcome Dori Tunstall. Dori is a design anthropologist, a public intellectual, and a book author of Decolonizing Design, a Cultural Justice Guidebook. Her guidebook inspires us to transform the way we imagine and remake the world, replacing pain and repression with equity, inclusion, and diversity. As the first Black female dean of design of OCAD University in Toronto, Dori's global career has earned her prestigious awards for setting new standards in the design industry. She's been called a crusader, a trailblazer, and a visionary, and I think you'll see why shortly. We can't wait to speak with you, Dori. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Liz.
So, some quick questions to begin. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite way to start the morning?
I go for a walk with my aunt.
Like with your aunt.
I live with my 74-year-old aunt. And so the thing is now, like, we get up around 6:30, 7 in the morning. So when the light comes out, like between 7 and 8, we go for a 30-minute walk almost every day.
Oh, that's beautiful. Do you have an agenda that you talk about, or is it silence?
It's like silence or just like humming or whatever. It's mostly just just absorbing the beauty of the morning. There's not a lot of cars out. We have different routes that we kind of take. So to avoid kind of doom scrolling the first thing in the morning, I was like, okay, let's just get up and go for a walk. And then we can doom scroll. So that's where, that's my... I've been doing that now for like 3 months. I feel like it's 3 months we've been doing that.
Oh, you inspire me. I'm going to do the same. May I?
Yes, please.
Copy that practice.
I offer it generously, and I've learned it from others. So, you know.
Oh, it's beautiful. Well, now that begs me to ask, what's your favorite way to end the day?
Watching Japanese anime.
Unexpected. Why?
I think it started, I've always loved Japanese anime, and I realized during the pandemic, it was the only thing that my mind could consume because it's like 22 minute episodes, and there's a bit of resolution. Most of the time it's like the underlying theme is like overcoming oppression and things like that. So it's a thing where like what calms me down, like if reading I get into. So if I try to read before, I'll read the book the whole entire night and I won't go to sleep. But okay. I'll watch maybe one or two episodes of Japanese anime, and it's enough to kind of depressurize me, take me out of my head, and then lull me into kind of a gentle sleep.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Final warm-up question is, what is your favorite creativity tool, broadly defined?
Video. It's a thing I grew up in the, you know, I came to age in the 1980s with MTV. So music and videos have always been like the creative medium of expression. And so I really like, and again, it, you know, you have to write, you have to understand graphics. So it brings all those things together. Yeah. But I really, really love making video, and the technology tools now to do that are so, so much easier that it is actually my true form of creative expression.
Interesting. Are you willing to share a project on which you're working?
Well, so you'll ask me about like where, you know, where people will find me. So I have a Patreon, which is called Living Liberatory Joy. So I post, I do Meme Dance Monday. So I post my dance videos there.
And it's you and dancing.
It is me dancing.
Oh, I love it.
Like every 2 weeks, I try to find like a popular meme dance and I train myself to do it for those 2 weeks. And then I do like a short snippet of it and then I post it. But again, there's like video production that comes into that. And then there's Joy Burst, which again, twice a week, I do like a 1 to 2 minute quick video. And again, it's like the choir sound. I have to write a quick script. I have to like, you know, film content. And so those are like my form of creative expression. You thought those were going to be quick.
You are the gift that keeps giving. You just, it's like the, yes, there's so much in there. Starting with your career, moving on, you are described as a design anthropologist. So first, I would love you to describe what that is. And then the other thing I'd like to say is, how did you get started in design? Did you start off as a design anthropologist? Was it a slow progression? Share.
So as a design anthropologist, what it means is I'm really interested in three things. I'm interested in values, so kind of people's values, community values, and how that gets translated by design into tangible experiences, right? So how design helps make tangible, invisible, and debatable, and whatever, the values that we hold, right? Which the values that we hold is just culture, right? That we want to pass on to future generations. Like that is the modality of culture, is to say these are the values. And the way in which we do that is there's intangible form, right? But there's also tangible form. So I focus on the tangible forms in which we say we want to pass this off to future generations. And then I look at, okay, where's a misalignment between the design and what people are experiencing? So then can we redesign stuff so people experience what they're really wanting to? Yeah. Or do we have to think about a whole new set of values to which we need to give design because the experiences that people are having are so terrible?
So can that's you make, what I give me a. I love that. Can you give me a really concrete example of how?
The example I always talk about is like in my career, I did a lot of work with Design for Democracy. This is coming off of the 2000 elections debacle.
Which was what? Just for our listeners, in case they don't know about the debacle.
So in year 2000, the design of a poor ballot in Dade County, Florida, decided the whole direction of the election. And so at the time, we had George Bush versus Al Gore. Very, very close, as most of our elections have been. Mm-hmm. And because some people misread the alignment between what's called a butterfly ballot, so you have things to vote for on both sides, that people chose in that county the wrong person that they voted for. And Al Gore, through intervention of the Supreme Court, lost that county, which meant he lost Florida, which meant George Bush won the election. Yeah. And it changed the whole trajectory of the United States based on that. So after that, a lot of designers got together to address the specific problem of design, right? I got involved. There was a group called Very in Chicago. I got involved with them. At the time, I was doing, again, user experience strategy for, eLab/Safehand. So I got involved in terms of helping them do the ethnographic research to understand what the voters' experience was. Then we created an opportunity map on that research. And then the students, again, because we were working with University of Illinois Chicago students, developed a whole wide range of prototypes to be able to support that, including new ballots, which then led to work with the Election Assistance Commissions, where Design for Democracy actually designed kind of the prototypes for all different types of ballots to make them inclusive, to make them, again, so that you don't have a design error in how you vote. So in that, the value was, what is democracy?
Yeah.
What does that mean to people? Then again, what do you have? All the designs that came out of that. So there was things that were for election judges, because that's a key part of their gatekeeper in the democratic process. There were things around the ballot. There was things, and again, electronic versus print ballots. There were things around the signage that you had in the election center. So again, the students prototyped all of these different things, which again, were put in implementation. And then again, we then evaluated through usability, evaluated through things, what people's experiences were, and then redesigns happened with that. But also, again, we went through and like, okay, what is democracy actually really mean to people? So there was things about, well, we've improved the voting experience, but people don't understand, like, the reporting that happens, like, what's the outcomes of your vote? Like, not a lot of places, let's say in Chicago, you vote for judges. I'm in LA, you vote for judges. The outcomes of that, you don't get a report on in the same way that you could report on Senate and whatever. But those are the kinds of things that really matter on the local level. So then there's the work around, like, how do we improve the information that comes back around the outcomes of election? Because that's actually what makes people feel that they're in a democratic society, right? So that's example. So all of that was like a design anthropology engagement, right?
Wow. So how, okay, back, that was a great illustration, but how in the world do you get into this? Like when you're two, when you're like five, like, or when you're in kindergarten, in kindergarten, you're learning how to count, you know, count and read and things like that. Like, what were you learning how to do? And how'd you get into this?
Okay, so this is the design and anthropology part. So the anthropology part is I've always been curious about people.
Okay.
And why they think the way they do and why they engage in the way in which they do. And for a long time, when I was younger, I was like, oh, I'm going to become a neurosurgeon, because that's around trying to understand how people think, right?
Okay. Okay, but surgeon is also an intervention.
Yes.
It's interesting, yes. Right? Like, yes. you're always an interventionist. You knew,
yes,
you wanted to intervene,
yes,
not just,
yes,
study.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. But you thought you'd have a scalpel, not a graphic, you know, not a, Photoshop or whatever you.
So when I did my undergraduate degree at Bryn Mawr College in Philadelphia, again, I was like going to be a biochemistry double major. But I took my first.
Wicked smart.
But I took my first anthropology class, and it was a thing where it was the first one I took was physical anthropology, because it's the best way to learn anatomy.
Oh.
And okay. And they had a medical anthropology course where, okay, I was like, if I'm going to be a doctor and I can understand what people think, this is perfect. I can understand how medicine needs to operate different places around the world. So once I took an anthropology class, I was like, this is what I love. Like, this is, instead of a scalpel, this is actually a better tool to understand how people think in their own way, right? Like, the beauty of it is, like, with the scalpel, is just like you're cutting out pieces of self, right? With this, it's like you're trying to understand people from their own perspective without the imposition of, like, any kind of scaffolding that comes from the culture that you belong from, right? Or at least try to put those in dialogue. So that's like, okay, this is a better tool. Anthropology is a better tool for intervention. And the design came about through the fact that, like, I was always in art classes and engaged in art classes. So I knew the importance of form making as a way of, again, intervening in the world, offering new possibilities. So even through my junior project in my anthropology class.
In college.
In college.
Okay.
Was a puppet show I made Indonesian shadow puppets, Japanese boonraku puppets, designed all the costumes, designed and made all the masks. I was working in with a puppeteer who was our theater professor that year. So that was like my junior project, was like a puppet show on Homo habilis, which is the first humans that we say discovered the use of fire. The story of Prometheus from Greek mythology, and then throwing in all this other stuff from other cultures. So that's when I was like, I didn't have the language to say I was a design anthropologist, but I already knew that I was combining together form and content, right? In ways that was contextualized around culture. So by the time I get to grad school, my PhD thesis is considered one of the most challenging and original, because for every chapter, I had a different format based on, I did my PhD research in Ethiopia. And so every chapter had a different format based on my understanding of like the vernacular expression of the place. And again,
can you give a concrete example?
So one of the places that I visited as part of my research is I was looking at Ethiopian tourism and development. And so there's a region called Aksum, which is in the north. And this is where they tell the story of the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. So this is where that story comes from. And again, they use these very graphic strips to tell these stories. So my entire chapter on Aksum was in the form of that graphic strip.
Wow.
So I did all the drawings for that chapter. And my four professors, they didn't know what to do, because they're like, we are just assuming she's a genius. You know, the documentation is all there, but we have no idea what to do with this dissertation. But there's nothing they could do because all the data was there. Like, again, I wrote the first chapter in perfect academese, where I was explaining that the rest of the story will be told in these various forms of like Ethiopian vernacular expression. And so they had no idea what to do with it. But I passed. That's how I got my PhD from Stanford. But so that's, Dory, again, when I knew I didn't have the language for it, but I knew I was doing something that worked on the intersections of design and anthropology. And when it wasn't until I went, so from that, I'm in Stanford during like Y2K, right? So I graduated, got my degree from Stanford in 1999, right?
Can you explain what Y2K is?
In the 1990s, there was a great fear that when we turn from the 90s into the year 2000, a lot of technology would fail because they had been programmed with kind of like a reset date in which they would go back to zero because no one was thinking about 2000. So much money was put in by companies in a way that like so much money is put into AI now. So much money was put into companies to prepare for this impending global technology disaster of Y2K, so that all of our technologies didn't fail when 1999 turned into 2000. So I was in the heart of Silicon Valley during these times. Again, no ambition necessarily to go into that space, but there were companies like eLab, which became Sapient. There were companies like IDEO that were there trying to figure out what this technology, what is this internet going to mean to people? And again, there was already models. So we had like Dr. Genevieve Bell, who was like a sort of a senior of mine, right? Who had gone into Intel Corporation. So I knew that there were people who were already looking at what technology would mean. Like, what is this? What are the values that are coming through this new technological design that needs to happen? And I was like, okay, I can go into an anthropology department and, you know, talk about Ethiopian tourism and development, or I can be on the forefront of in some ways helping to define and design what these new technologies would mean to people in everyday life, right?
Okay.
I got into technology design. I was always a thing when all my classmates said that I had gone into Elab Sapia, all of these sort of things, they were like, we are not surprised. We are not surprised that this is where you would be. But I didn't have a name for it until Ken Anderson, who had done his title when he had a short stint at Apple, and he had gone to Intel. His title was a design anthropologist. And so all of a sudden I had a title for what it is that I had been doing actually for a really long time, but didn't have the language to describe it.
So two themes that I'm hearing come up are your conviction of intuition, that you were onto something. You didn't have the words for it, but you were onto something. And then coupled with confidence, right? You write this PhD dissertation. The first chapter is according to the rules, and then the rest is not. So tell me, what is your source of confidence, and where can we get some of this? It's brilliant. How do you decide to do that? And what keeps you going when there's so many messages around you saying, do it the way it's always been done, Dori?
Well, this is where I think my identity actually comes into a fore. So again, I am a Black cis woman who... again, has a neurodiversity, and I'm gifted. So people don't think of giftedness as a neurodiversity, but it is. My brain actually operates in different ways, right? And so the combination of all of those things means I'm always on the outs. Always on the outs. So then the question becomes do you assimilate into it? Do you begin to redefine yourself so that you fit into it? Or do you just say, okay, I'm on the outs, so let me just do what I do, and hopefully people will see it, hopefully people will recognize it, hopefully I can build a community around it. But again, I have to be true to who I am. And, and from a perspective, the advantage is that I've entered spaces where innovation is really considered a value. Or of value. So you only get new stuff from people who are bringing different and new perspectives that you've not encountered before. And so even at Stanford, Stanford rewrote the rules for how you do a PhD dissertation because there was nothing, actually, I had followed
all... Did they expand them or did they constrain them? They expanded them. Okay, this is good.
They constrained them. Because what it is that because you go through this check. So they went through all the things and I did everything that you said you were supposed to have, right?
Sure.
But I did all these extras where I didn't have end notes. I had side notes because I was like, well, why would you want to go to the bottom or somewhere else? You should just read those side by side, right? And they're like, no one's done that before. And I'm like, I had my name on each page at the bottom of the header with a thing. And they're like, no one's done that before. And I had all this imagery. I had gone and worked to get all these programming. So I have the language in Amharic script, Gia script. And so I'd done all these things that didn't break any of the rules. But they just never saw them. And then all of a sudden, they were like, oh, we might need to change the rules.
And you graduated in 99. So this may explain why when I submitted my dissertation in 2007, there were an inordinate amount of rules. And I thought, why in the world are there all these rules? So now I know it was you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Dori.
I'm sorry.
Well, and what I'm humored by is similarly, I did not do that with my dissertation, but I was in a PhD seminar at Stanford and we were supposed to write essays, reflection essays, weekly reflection essays. And instead I submitted a cartoon and I submitted it. And my classmates said, you're going to get kicked out of the program for doing that.
I do that all the time.
Well, thank you. This professor said he had never received a cartoon response to academic, you know, written papers and still speaks of it to this day. So yay. I think you were ahead of the time. I wish I had known that. Okay, so you've already listed several
places that several, I worked.
Yeah, several defining moments or learning moments, perhaps. I'm wondering if there's a surprising thing you learned in your journey. Was there that you haven't shared yet or that you would like to share? It sounds like, I don't know if much surprises you, but I still want to ask that.
Well, I guess the thing I would say, and I was thinking about this a lot, where the thing that I found most surprising is that once you get a seat at the table, you realize that it's not so special to be there.
Ah, okay. And, say more. Tables are you sitting at? Give us an example. Well, give us a concrete example.
So again, please. It's a thing where, you know, like, If you're smart and talented, and then you're kind of, there's this expectation set that you want to belong in these elite spaces. And again, like, you know, Bryn Mawr College, it's an elite institution, Stanford, elite institution.
Absolutely.
Working in these high tech, you know, in these elite institutions. It's a thing you're told, like, this is what you should aspire to. This is what you should aspire to. This is why you're working so hard. And yep. You get there and you realize, like, it's not so special to be there. And I'll give a very concrete example. Stanford is a place that has really, really smart, intelligent people. So this is, like, not saying anything about that, right? Like, it is what it is. And for me, what was special about it was actually just more so than being surrounded by really smart, intelligent people, was actually the diversity of people that I was around, in the sense of, like, there was a strong Native American student population. I was in anthropology. So again, it was quite, our classmates were quite global and diverse and whatever. And that to me is, like, that was the thing that was special about being at Stanford. Like, everyone's like, oh, let's add 50 points to your IQ because you went to Stanford. But but to me, it's like, no, actually what was special about Stanford was, like, that was the first time that I saw reflected the level of, like, domestic and global diversity can exist in a room and the interchange of perspectives that could happen when you have that level of diversity. And so in all aspects of my career, I gravitate to those spaces and places. So when I went into industry, again, working at Sapient, what I loved the most about it was the diversity of people from all over the world who are working there. Again, all people, like, on the top of the game. I would say to this day, I've never worked with smarter people than I did on my teams. at, like, Sapient. But again, it's a thing where we're told the thing about being in those places is to have the seat at the table. But actually,
common language.
Right. And that's, like, to earn the prestige of being in these places. But what you find is that the value is not in the prestige of being in these places. The value is, at least for me, was, like, to be able to be surrounded by so much diversity of perspectives, so many diversity of experiences, and be in exchange with that. So it broadens your whole perspective of what is possible in the world. Mm. And so that's the thing that has surprised me in my journey as most, because everyone's like, oh, Dory, there's this elite place, you should be there. And I'm like, yeah, okay, but I'm not interested in the prestige part. I'm interested in, like, who is there in the room. And that's the thing that's really sad that's happening right now in terms of, like, the attempt to dismantle the diversity of gender, the diversity yeah. of, like, peoples in the room, because yeah. like, that was actually the thing that was special in any of these yeah. elite institutions that I am. And if that disappears again, then, like I said, those places are actually not very important, actually, tables to be at, right? because you're not going to learn anything being at those quote unquote seats at those tables.
Hmm. This is making me think about your book. And what I love about your book is you introduce new frameworks from non-Eurocentric cultures. And I'm wondering if there's frameworks or ideas or principles that we could take that would help us think about that. Because even just the language of the table, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much to dissect in that as a Eurocentric construct. So I'm curious if there's what it makes you think of. Are there models we can learn and be inspired by? I know you taught me first about the seven generation principles, which I'm hoping we can get to and you can define. Is there anything in that we can draw on when thinking about where we are right now and the time?
I think actually the term I think of that really expresses kind of the moment we're in now is actually sort of the Indigenous concept, and for me, it comes to me through the Anishinaabe, who are, again, one of the original custodians of the land of Toronto and other areas, but a very large Native American Indigenous group, right? Okay. A language group, actually. There's this concept of all my relations.
Okay.
And all my relations, what it does is that it broadens our understanding of to whom we have relationships of obligations of care, right? So in the sense of all my relations is that you care for other human beings and in the broadest sense, right? Like anyone who is needed, anyone who is vulnerable, the ethos is that your first response is a response of care. That is your obligation, is to care. Yet we are in kinship with the land. We are in kinship with the other plants. We're in kinship with the other animals. We're in kinship with all of these other, we're in kinship with the air. We're in kinship with the moon. We're in kinship with all these things. And so the other aspect is reminding is that, let's say, if your sense of a relationship between, let's say, you and your siblings is one that is expected, obligated to be of love and care. This animal is your sibling. This water, this lake is your sibling. This piece of land here, this hill is your sibling. The air that you breathe is not even your sibling. It's like, it's your grandparent or great-grandparents to whom you oh, great obligations for giving you life, right?
Yeah.
So for me, it's that sense of all my relations, because the ideal of having a seat at the table is actually to constrain the sense of like who we're meant to care for, right? Mm. So if you're at the table, then you're only supposed to care about the opinions of those mm-hmm. who are at that table, right? But if you're coming from a sense of all my relations, like there doesn't have to be a table. Everything that is there around you, everything that you're in interdependency with, is something that you have an obligation to care for. It's not about rights. You don't have a right to be cared for, right? It's about your obligation to care. And that's kind of that's what I was feeling. Right. When I was in these spaces, right, where it's like I am optimizing my ability to care for people across all ranges of differences, right, that I hadn't even taken in consideration because I hadn't encountered them before. Whereas the sense of like, OK, you're at Stanford University, you're the elite of the elite of the elite. Like, I was like, that's not a table I don't want to sit at that table, actually. Right. I'd rather roam around in the heels and bring a bunch of people with me because this table is too small. This room is too small. This lecture hall might be too small. So let's just go hang out in the foothills and commune with everything, right?
Oh, this is something I've always admired about you is you're to make something new. Like you're not afraid to walk out the door and start something new and have confidence that people, you'll do this in community with others. You're not going out at it alone.
Yeah. And that's always the challenging balance, right? Like, I always say, like, to people, it's like, you're not a leader until there's two people who are willing to follow you. Mm. And then they're the ones who actually make the leader, right? Like, you could just be the one wandering out there alone. Yeah. But it is, and the first person who might be there, like, they just might be like, out there with you. But if you get two people who are willing to join with you in that, like, okay, that defines the space of leadership, right? That defines amplification. But the leader is created by the willingness of those two people to see themselves in the possibilities that you've opened up.
Yes. And so, I love, go ahead.
So there's always a moment of feeling like that isolation. Until those two people join in, right?
Yeah. I've been thinking lately about the pedestal upon which, and also an interesting word with problems, but the pedestal we put leadership upon and the criticality of followership. And that I think too often we say people go for leadership, but don't realize that my point of view is that to be in a successful society, we need people to take in both roles. You need to be both a leader in subdomains and a follower in others. And I'd love to hear your reaction to that. How do you think about that?
So
word pedestal. I'm so sensitive to the language using with you, because I'm realizing how problematic so much of it is.
Yeah, it's okay. Like, again, like, what I appreciate is, like, your willingness to engage in, like, the understanding of, like, oh, this has a, there's something that comes with this word, right? It is heavier than we actually use it, right? So let's dig in. So the thing that I'm learning is I am a terrible follower. And it's a thing where, you know, like, you're asking, what are the things that you want to, like, learn to do? I want to learn to be a better follower.
Okay, mostly say more.
Because, like, mostly to be the path breaker is a lot of work. It's a lot of labor, right? And the advantage that the follower has is that someone has already broken the path for them a little bit. So it's a little less work for them to be able to follow. So there's a part of me that wishes I was a better follower, just because it would be, like, far less energy to expend to be able to have impact in the world, right? Like, so it's not like a sense of laziness. It's just like, I wish I could just kind of follow along what others are doing and contribute in a way that, you know, they find useful or whatever, where I'm not having to, again, open up a new pathway, right? Yeah. I don't have to carry the machete. I can carry the light.
Yeah. Oh, right. Well, I want to push back and say, I think this is a first. I'm seeing this as an act, not your first, but an act of followership, and that you agreed to talk on this podcast.
Okay.
To be sure, we asked you because you're a leader. We asked you because of the things you've done. But this was an invitation for you to engage, you know, in the questions. So I think you are on the right path.
Thank you. I will totally take that, because I need it. I need it. But again, it's a thing where but it's also a thing, like, for me, leadership is following, right? So I'm gonna contradict myself in a way.
Please do. Please do.
The thing that I find, like, there are a couple of gifts that I bring as a person. My first gift is that I'm actually able to synthesize a wide range of different perspectives. And I can hold them. I can hold all that complexity in my head and act upon that in a way that, in some ways, people realize that they are part of whatever it is that I've set up, right?
That's a gift.
And I, again, it's a thing, like, I own it as a gift, again, it's one of those things that you hone as a skill as an anthropologist, because again, your job as an anthropologist is to be able to imaginatively leap out of your own thoughts and systems to be able to connect to someone else's, right? The other gift that I bring in many cases is that, like, I think at the level, I can see the connections between the vision, the strategy, which is in some ways for me the prioritization, and the tactical stuff that needs to happen. So when I have an idea, that ideal already comes with the plan and the number of toilet paper rolls that have to be bought, right? In order to sustain that.
Can you give me a concrete example of this? I love that it comes down to the toilet paper rolls. Can you give me a concrete example of something that's happened in the last couple of years where you both had the vision and the strategy and the number of toilet paper rolls all figured out?
Okay, let's see. Because that's the thing. This is what I do every day, so it's really hard to pick out an example that's like super crucial. But what I'll do is, so there was an initiative I started when I was a dean of design at OCAD University, which is called It's My Future Toronto. And what was the point was to engage 8 to 12-year-olds, Indigenous, Black, and POC-focused in designing, in some ways, like in this case, the immediate thing was what should be the recovery response from COVID for the city of Toronto, because I was on their recovery board. And I was like, okay, there's a voice missing. It's the voice of youth. So let me set up something to embrace that voice, right?
Okay.
And so the moment I had that idea, I had already had conversations. So again, this is coming after 2020 and, you know, the murder of George Floyd. So you had a lot of companies wanting to, like, how do we do the right thing, right? And so I was like, this is how you do the right thing. We're going to set up this initiative. We're going to engage with Globe and Mail, which is the major newspaper in Toronto. Sidley, which is one of the major advertising agencies, like they're the ones, if you're into basketball, they did the We the North campaign for the Raptors when they won.
Okay.
And then the city government. So I'm like, we're going to knit all of those things together. I already had the Gantt chart. So the moment I had the ideal, I already knew, like, these are the players that I can slot in. Here's the Gantt chart. So we need to develop all these videos. We need to have them up there, and then we'll engage in all of these Zoom sessions with the youth to be able to bring their projects forward. This is how long it's going to take. We'll have a big event, the virtual event, right? Written up in the newspapers, all these kinds of things for it. So when I first conceived of that idea, like instantaneously, the Gantt chart was in place because I already had conversations about how to slot the different teams. And then it was a thing like refining in terms of, like, again, okay, we're going to need more time for this because we have this deadline coming up. We're going to have need more time for this. But again, in that moment where I said, we need It's My Future Toronto initiative, boom, here's the Gantt chart and this is what needs to happen. And then the toilet paper aspect of it, again, it's like, okay, I need to get the domain name. So I need to research and make sure someone else doesn't own the domain names. Okay, so let's get the domain name. Okay, we need to get people who are really good at making films. So we're going to talk to, like, one of our top directors in the city. And then they're going to, like, help create the guide, right, to be able to do this, right? So all of that happens, like, really rapidly for me. Because it's composed in my head. And then it becomes transcribed into an Excel spreadsheet that helps me communicate this to others.
How do you feel when somebody comes to you and questions a premise of one of your visions? And
well,
how do you handle
it? So that is the thing. That is something I've learned to cultivate. Like, it used to bother me a lot. Because what it meant, like, again, it's like I see the whole picture. So sometimes it's frustration because something someone would suggest, like I already thought through all the ramifications of what that is. And I can tell you all the 964 ways in which that's not going to work, which people don't like when you do that. So I learned very quickly to stop doing that. Even though I was right, it's just not nice to tell people that. The other thing that I've learned to do is the best way in which I've done that is like I say, okay, I'm going to lay this out. And I've learned to do it in forms that are like I don't do the full color thing anymore or whatever. I try to do it so that people feel that they can enter into this space. So I've learned to not present things as fully formed as they may actually be in my head. The other thing I've learned to do is to when people give that, I don't give an immediate reaction. So I says like, this sounds very interesting. Let me give a day or so to process what this might all mean. But I feel like it's a good idea, right? So I've learned to do that. And then what I'll do is I'll take what it is I do, synthesize that and see how it changes the whole configuration. And if it fits in, then it's like, okay, that's fine. Okay. Yeah. If it doesn't, then what I can do is to sort of explain is like, if we do this, and I'm fine with going in this direction, the things that we have to address will be this, 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 and this.
Yeah.
And then that way, they don't feel that they rejected, but then they have to take on the obligation of figuring out the problems that now have to be solved if we embrace this approach, right? And it's not aligning with everything else. So I've learned to cultivate different ways of like approaching that. And it, so it doesn't bother me anymore. I just expect it to happen. And I allot time for it to happen and I don't take it personally, but I'm also in a place where I very quickly realize when things are not in alignment. And so just this week, there was someone who wanted to work together on the project. And again, my instincts were saying, like, this doesn't feel right. This doesn't feel right. But this doesn't feel right. But I said, like, but let's just trust the process and see if we get there. And it got to the point where it's like when they fully laid out what it is that they were about, I was like, oh, OK, we're just not in alignment. And that's not personal. There's nothing wrong with that. It just means we need to each go in our own direction. And if there's another opportunity in the future connect, we can do so. But this is not it, right?
Yeah.
And so I've learned to respect that aspect as well of just like, actually, some things are just in misalignment and it's not, and that's okay. Because it just means you now have the opportunity to focus your energy on that which is in alignment, right?
Beautiful. So what is on the spirit of alignment? What is in alignment right now? And very specifically, what are you excited that you are working on today? What's one thing you're excited about?
So I'm really excited about, so I'm working on my second book, which is Super Tokens, the First and Onlys in Design and Tech. And it's
Super Tokens is the title.
So it's taking the idea of super tokens that I talked about in chapter 4 of the book, of Decolonizing Design book. And I've been interviewing. So I've done about 25 interviews. I want to do maybe like 10, 15 more of people who have been like the first and or the onlys in design in tech.
Oh, fun.
And it's all very, like, again, it's a thing where I'm writing it from the collective we, because what people, many of the people that I've interviewed, are, again, are under NDAs.
Yes, right.
And so they have been so open and generous in sharing to me, like, what their true experiences are in these elite institutions, right, that they belong to across business, tech, academia, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm excited about that because even now as things are really difficult for, again, people who have been able to benefit from the policies of diversity, equity, inclusion, right? as they are finding themselves constrained or threatened in their institutions. Again, I'm taking a lot of calls with people about like how to work through that and decide where it is that they really want to be. And this book, because people have been so open and generous around what their true experiences are, will help guide people in terms of like, how do you navigate your career and figure out whether you are aligned with being in these elite institutions, right? So that's what I'm most excited about.
Wow. I can't wait to read that. We'll end on the question of what unexpected advice do you have for those entering design right now?
Well, I think for me, it's two things. One, stay in trouble. I say this all the time. I used to say this all the time to students at OCAD. And they would always be surprised because it's like the last thing you expect is your dean to tell you to stay in trouble.
Yeah.
But what I mean by that is that if you are pushing against, in some ways, the injustices that exist in our systems, then you will always be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You will always be in trouble. And so, you know, I don't want to characterize it as like rebellious because it's a reaction to something. But I think, again, if you come from a different perspective on things, right,
mm-hmm.
you're always going to be challenging the system that exists and lean into the fact that you're going to stay in trouble, right?
Yes. I love that.
And I think let's meet the moment where we are, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of like mm-hmm. fascism works because people are afraid to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the willingness to stay in trouble is the seed of every liberatory act that one makes, not just for yourself, but also for others in the world. So I always say stay in trouble, and it makes people laugh. But it is the only way that we can push back against systems of oppression, systems of exploitation, systems of harm that we, again, like, what's happening now is not new.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The thing that it is hyper transparent in a way that it hasn't been before, which means we know exactly what it is that we're facing, which means that we can cause the trouble, right? With greater accuracy, right?
Yeah, yeah. I want to share, there's a wonderful running race in San Francisco called Beta Breakers, where you run from the bay out to the ocean, and 99% of the runners go in one direction, the 7-mile run. But there's a small group of runners that are called the Salmon Runners, who run the race in the opposite direction. And I'm reminded of this because what I love about them, and they wear salmon costumes, it's just fabulous. But what I'm reminded of is that they know that by running the opposite direction, they will run into people. Like there's no question. They're going to run into people. They're going to do their best to swerve in and out, but it's not the easiest way to run the 7 miles. But they're committed. And so I'm thinking about
be salmon.
Be a salmon swimmer is what I'm that's the metaphor I'm coming up with. Did you have a second one you were going to share? I thought you had two.
Well, I think it's just this ideal of like, especially in your career, it's really important to align the work you do with your values, right? And sometimes you feel like you're not able to do so. But I always say is that like people are like, well, you know, how did you come to, you know, lead and help all this work in decolonization? It's like, well, I started always start it with, like, what is the area in which I have control over? If I have control over just, like, what image needs to go on this particular page, then I'm going to
make it. As a graphic designer.
I'm going to make a decision about that image that's aligned with my values, which is, again, my values are like liberatory joy, right? What is it? Liberation is being able to say no to things that might harm you and your communities and your environment. Joy is about connection. So dismantling anything that keeps you from connecting to another person, right? So whenever I make a decision or something, even if it's just a tiny image, I'm like, how is that contributing to liberatory joy, right? Mm-hmm. So that is the value system that I am carrying with me. So it means that, like, in the work that I do, I'm working very, very hard to make sure the engagements that I'm having isn't aligned with that. And it means, in some ways, letting go to some of, like, the elite institutions that I would probably like to embrace or be embraced by. But realizing it's like, oh, but they're probably actually not aligned with the values that I'm trying to be. So what would I bring in terms of my talents if I'm in that space? Mm. And again, sometimes you need to be in those spaces to help the institution see how they can transform. But again, it's that thing that's like, but I'm only there then to bring them into closer alignment with my values, which is a very different attitude to enter a space or an institution than saying, I'm trying to belong here, right? So those two things kind of go in it together, right? It's like
they do.
The salmon is going the way they're meant to go.
To go,
you go, you know, up, you know, they go against the stream, right? So they have to be in alignment with that, but it means they're going to be in trouble.
Yes, Dory, I can't thank you enough.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your stories with us. What an absolute gift. Every time I talk to you, I walk away with so many new insights, and I know our audience will as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Again, it's always a great conversation. So
always. You make me think in new ways. That is a gift. I can't thank you enough. Thank you for listening to the Technical Difficulties podcast, produced by the Center for Human-Computer Interaction and Design and McCormick School of Engineering at Northwestern University. That was Dory Tunstall. And you can find out more about her in the show notes. You can learn more about the show by going to technicaldifficultiespodcast.com. Drop us a note at technicaldifficultiesteam@gmail.com or leave us a review on your favorite podcast app.